Okay, lesson 23, the sovereignty of God. God is Lord and sovereign over all. Yeah, John Murray. If you're not familiar with the name of John Murray, you should be familiar with the name of John Murray. In particular, one of his books, Redemption Accomplished and Applied, is just an extraordinary book, but a very sound theologian. But John Murray, there's an excerpt that I have here from him on the sovereignty of God, and I just want to hit some of the highlights here. The sovereignty of God, he says, I take, and if there's a key word in this sentence, it's the word absolute. Absolute authority, rule, and government. Absolute authority, rule, and government in the totality of all that is. That's the point that he's making. It's not partial, it's not conditional, it's not temporary, it's eternal, it's unlimited, it's infinite, it's absolute. He goes on to say that it's what he describes as not mere uniqueness or supremacy or transcendence. In other words, it's not that God is a better God than something else. He's the only God. That's the point that he's making. He alone is God. He alone, the singularity of God, the uniqueness of God. Deuteronomy 4, he is God in heaven above. Well, let me back up a little bit. The Lord, he is God. There is none else, none else. God alone is God, none else besides him. He is God in heaven above and upon the earth beneath. There is none else. So in Deuteronomy 4, twice here we have references in verses 35 and 39. No other, none else. And there's this book that I've referenced in the past by Barrett, None Greater, and it's a wonderful book. But it's not as if when we say none greater, it's not that God has rivals and that he simply is greater than the rest. He alone is truly great. He alone is God. In Deuteronomy 6, of course, a passage that we should all be familiar with, the Shema, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, or the Lord our God is one God, Echad, one in multiple persons, obviously. And then Deuteronomy 32, I am God, he goes on to say, and there is no God with me. He alone is God. He's single is the nature of God. Second Kings, thou alone art God. God alone, the uniqueness of God. And that's pivotal to our understanding of sovereignty in terms of absolute authority, absolute rule, absolute government. And then the point is, so what would be our responsibility given the fact that God alone is God and that there's none else? And the response, of course, would be that we owe him as our creator, as our sustainer, as our provider, as our monarch, as the God of the universe, our utter and complete and unconditional obedience and loyalty. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and the consequence is to love the Lord, to love God with all of our heart, the totality of our heart, and all of our soul, and all of our mind, and all of our strength. And the point that's being made here is not to break the human being into different parts. It's just the point that's being made is that all of us in our totality, without any reservation, without holding back in any form or fashion, to love God. And to love God is to serve him, to honor him, to recognize him for all that he is, who he is, and to worship the Lord thy God in him only, Matthew 4. And it presupposes this doctrine of sovereignty that creation, he goes on to describe this, is by fiat. And that's a term that perhaps you're not familiar with. The word fiat means decree or an act of the will or a declaration. So how did God create the heavens and the earth? He simply said, let there be. It was an act of his will. And there was. And there was light and there was earth and the sky and the seas and all that fills them. So when we talk about creation by fiat, it's just a technical term that means it was an act of God's will, his unconditional will, his own free will. Let there be, and there was. And he needed no assistance. He didn't take more than six ordinary days. It wouldn't have required six more than, it wouldn't have required six ordinary days if he didn't intend it to. He designed things that way so that he could separate the seventh day as a day when he ceased from rest, so that he would be able to show us that one day in seven is to be set aside unto God. But creation by fiat, by command, by decree, by an act of his sovereign will, because he's God, he alone is God, absolutely independent. God answers to no one, to nothing. Everything that exists, exists because God willed it. Why did he create? Because it pleased God, because it was something that gave him pleasure. It was according to his purposes. So what are the implications of a non-sovereign God? And I won't read all of this for you, but R.C. Sproul has said so much, so helpful, in terms of a very understandable approach to some of the more penetrating doctrines like the sovereignty of God. And he talks about the fact, it's on page 2 of your notes, he says, I explain it this way. If there is one molecule in the universe running loose, some independent-minded molecule outside the control of God's sovereignty, what I like to call, Sproul says, one maverick molecule, then the implication of that is that there's no guarantee for us that any future promise that God has made to his people will pass. And the point that he's making is that God is in absolute, unconditional control of everything, that there is no molecule that is independent of God. And so because of that, when God decrees something, it always happens in the way that he decrees it, at the time he decrees it, in the manner he decrees it, etc. There's nothing that's independent of God. Every molecule, he goes on to say, and you can read this little anecdote at your leisure, but he concludes his point by saying there's no maverick molecules in a universe where God is sovereign. So nothing is independent. The only one who is independent in the universe is God. And God has always been independent. He always will be independent. He with or without a universe, God is independent. And when God spoke by declaration, he created all that is. He sustains it. He is the king over all, as we'll see. He's our creator. He's our sustainer, as we have seen in previous times. And the implication of the fact that he is creator, the fact that he is the sustainer, is that he is not only that, but that he is sovereign and he is Lord over all. And if there is a key word, it's all. All creatures, actions, things, from the smallest to the greatest. And how does he rule? He rules with perfect wisdom and power and righteousness, all of these things. That all of God's control over all that he's made is perfect in every way because that's his nature. It's always that way. And he's free to do everything in a way that pleases him according to his will and in a way that brings honor to him, brings glory to God. Whether we understand it or we have a part in it is not really a feature. Just everything that God does is according to his independent, perfect will. And it always is for his glory. And it's to the extent that it involves us, it's for our good. And it's always for his glory. So what does it mean? And to sort of break this doctrine of sovereignty and lordship into dimensions, we look at the aspect of the supremacy of God, And it's defined as being the highest, the ultimate, incomparable excellence, rank, and authority. Those are key words, excellence, rank, and authority. We'll break that out, but he is exalted above all. He is over all. He is more lofty, magnified, incomparable in his excellence, in his beauty, in his glory, in every possible dimension. God is incomparable. He is transcendent over all, exalted over all of his creation. Page 3 of your notes. This is extracted from that study guide by Paul Washer, that Knowing the Living God, and again, just to give credit where that's due, they've given permission to duplicate this, so you're getting at least parts of this along the way, and It's supplemented, as you can see, from other sources as well, but it's helpful to look at the pieces and supremacy dealing with God's person, dealing with his place, and dealing with his purpose. Person, place, and purpose. And when we said earlier, remember those three words, excellence, rank, and authority, that's what we're looking at here. When we're talking about the person of God, we're speaking of the excellence of God. When we're referring to the place of God, his station, if I can use that term, it equates to his rank, his position, his station. When we refer to his purpose, we're looking at his authority. So excellence, rank, authority, person, place, purpose. God's person, infinitely more excellent. There is none comparable. There is none greater, of incomparable worth, incomparable beauty, incomparable glory. When we look at his place, his station, his rank, there are none equals. There are no contenders for God. God alone is God. There is none else other than God. When we consider not only his person and his place, but the purpose of God, the authority that he has, it means that he is the one who directs all things. He governs all things. He orchestrates all things. We often will talk about the providence of God. That's a term that refers to his most holy, wise, and powerful directing and preserving all of his creatures and all of their actions. And all that he does, the providence is the outworking of his will. And so what we see taking place in history is a manifestation of his providence. There is nothing that is outside the providence of God. There are no maverick molecules. There are no people who are truly independent. Only one is independent, uniquely excellent in his rank and his authority, in his person, in his place, in his purpose. So there's titles that the scripture uses to convey these truths to us. These are concepts. How does the scripture describe this God, the God of the Bible, the God of all creation? Psalm 97, you are the Lord Most High, the Lord Most High over all the earth, exalted far above all gods. And when the psalmist is referring to exalted above all gods, it's not as if there are any other gods in a legitimate sense. There are beings, there are concepts, there are things that people worship that are not the true God. There are idols, of course. Even John Calvin said that our hearts are idol factories. We're prone by our own indwelling sin to constantly be manufacturing idols in our lives. But there is only one God, but the Lord Most High. Psalm 97, there are three psalms that we can describe as sovereignty psalms, and they all begin in the same way. Psalm 97, verse 1, 93, verse 1, 99, verse 1. The Lord reigns. Each of these psalms, 93, 97, 99, they all begin, verse 1, in exactly the same way. The Lord reigns. Psalm 93, the Lord reigns. He is clothed with majesty. He is clothed with strength. And so the psalmist describes the reign of God, R-E-I-G-N, of God. And he's clothed with majesty. It's the effulgence of his glory. It's the radiance of who he is. And he is clothed with not only with majesty, but with strength, his powerful, unlimited strength, his omnipotence. But the title, the Lord Most High, we talked last time about Elyon, but Yahweh Elyon, Most High is Elyon, and Yahweh is Lord. And actually, in these notes, it should be in the English, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, if you've got an English Bible that shows that it's done correctly. That's the way the translators wanted to make sure that the readers would understand that the word Lord that's being used there is Yahweh. We really don't know how it's pronounced. Sometimes they've taken the consonants and they've added vowels and they made it into Jehovah. That's where that comes from, by the way. But this is the covenant name of God. And capital L, small O-R-D, would be Adonai. And so If you're looking at capital L and then small ORD, that would be Adonai. If you're looking at capital L ORD, that would be Yahweh. That would be Jehovah. That would be the covenant name of God. And that's the way it's used here, is Yahweh, the Lord Most High. And it communicates these attributes of excellence, rank, and authority with respect to God. You also see that in Psalm 7, and you see it in Psalm 47. In addition to the three sovereignty psalms, Psalm 93, 97, 99, if you look at it a little more broadly, there's a group of psalms called enthronement psalms, Psalm 47, Psalm 93, Psalm 95 to Psalm 99 would all be enthronement psalms. And so they include the sovereignty psalms, but they're more broad, but they talk about the kingship of God, his unqualified reign, his total authority, his dominion over all of his creation. But these psalms refer to God's enthronement, to his kingship. Isaiah 57, thus says the high and exalted one who lives forever. So already we've got what? We've got his dominion, we've got his sovereignty, we've got his eternality, who lives forever, whose name is holy. So here we have the attribute of his holiness. I dwell, he says, in a high and a holy place. God is not contained in any place. He cannot be contained. He's incorporeal. God is a spirit and has not a body like man. So, but when it talks about I dwell in a high and holy place, that's the way in which God is describing, using language that we can understand, that he is exalted above everything else, that there is none that compares with God. What's beautiful about this is, look at what God goes on to say. He says, I live, I dwell in a high and holy place. And what does he do? And also with the contrite and the lowly of spirit, why does he do that? In order to revive the spirit of the lowly and to revive the heart of the contrite. Imagine the condescension of God, the one who exists in and of himself, his self-existence. He needs no one else. He's not lacking in anything. He created everything that exists for his own glory. He's of incomparable, immeasurable, infinite majesty, beauty, glory. And what does he do? He condescends to, this moves it from transcendence to immanence, immanence. He is present with us. He condescends to be with us. You remember the word Emmanuel? You know what that means? God with us. How did that take place? That took place in the incarnation. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was, and they became flesh, and he dwelt among us. God condescended not only in New Testament, in the person of Jesus Christ, but through his Holy Spirit to be with us, to minister to his creation. What condescension that God would dwell in a high and holy place, but also with those who are contrite, with those who are lowly in spirit. And why? To revive us. We need reviving. And God does that. God is, he humbles himself. He condescends, if you will, to be with us. He's not distant from us. He is high and exalted, and yet he is with us. He is present with us. I can't fully explain that, but I know it's true. Page 4 of the notes, these phrases, the high and exalted one, talks about his transcendence, his being over everything, above all things, and in whose name is holy. And holy refers to something being separate, something being set apart. You could have something, to use a human analogy, you could have an implement that would be consecrated to a particular use. It would be set apart for a particular use. But God is set apart in the ultimate sense from his creation. He's holy in the sense that he's set apart from his creation. And yet he's set apart not only from what he has made, but from all corruption, all decay, all sin. God has no entanglement with sin. He is utterly separate from that. And that creates, of course, the ultimate problem. How can and unholy creation have a relationship with a holy God? And the answer is, we can't, unless God provides a way for that which is unholy to have a relationship with Him. And we can't do that on our own. We're absolutely unable to do that on our own. We are all utterly unholy, and God is infinitely holy. And so this is the miracle of the gospel. This is the beauty of the gospel, that God has made a way for us who are unholy and have no possible way of having a relationship with God, to have salvation with Him, to be free from His judgment, to be delivered from transgression, to be delivered from His wrath. And that's the person of Jesus Christ, our substitute, who knew no sin, who took sin upon Himself, our sin upon Himself, and the wrath of God, the propitiation, the wrath of God upon Himself that we deserve. He took it upon Himself so that we, completely undeserving, could have and do have, through Jesus Christ and Him alone, a relationship with the One who is infinitely, perfectly holy. He is the high and exalted One, and you can know Him, if you're in Christ. And that's just an absolutely remarkable, almost an incomprehensible thing. How is it that we could have this relationship? It's all of grace. It is all of God's undertaking that we could have this, and we do have this relationship with Him. But the note's going to describe the supremacy of God, His exalted state in 1 Chronicles 29, verse 11. Six attributes described for us to further give us this palette of descriptions, this array of words that God has chosen to reveal Himself. Yours, O Lord, greatness, power, glory, victory, majesty. Indeed, everything that's in the heavens and the earth. Yours is the dominion. These are the attributes of God's sovereignty, His greatness and His power, His glory, His victory, His majesty, and ultimately His dominion, His rulership, His authority over all, His total, unqualified, absolute, infinite authority over all. And why does God have authority over all? Because, number one, because He is God, and He alone is God. And number two, because He has created and He sustains all that is, that we would not exist were it not for God's declaration. We would not continue were it not for God's sustaining power. And so it's only right that He would be not only great and powerful and glorious and victorious and majestic in everything, in every possible way, but in all dimensions He has dominion over all. And it goes on to describe in 1 Chronicles 29, and you exalt yourself as head over all. This is the One who exalts Himself as head over all, and yet He condescends to be with the one who is lowly, the one who is contrite in heart. I think that's why the Scriptures tell us that God is opposed to the proud, but He gives grace to the humble. The essence of pride is self-exaltation. The essence of pride is, this was the driving element in Lucifer's fall. I will be like the Most High. And so you have the created one seeking evil, seeking to be like the one who made him, to be like him. And of course we know that was his demise, his fall. It was Satan. Lucifer became Satan. Incorrigibly evil, eternally evil, the one who opposes God, the one who is our adversary. But God is opposed to the proud, but He gives grace to the humble. To be humble is to see ourselves rightly and to see God rightly. To be prideful is to see both ourselves and God in an altogether upside-down fashion. It's to exalt ourselves and to dethrone God. And that's why it's so evil. That's why, and pride is, in my view, the most pernicious of all sin, because it blinds the one who is prideful from the very nature of sin. The one who is prideful is oblivious to his or her sin, and it often is someone's undoing. unless God steps in and graciously and mercifully shows them and humbles them. And that sometimes is a very painful, well, it's always a very painful thing, but it's a good thing when God humbles us. It's a good thing when he reminds us of who we are and who he is. But attributes of God is greatness. He is eternally great. He is unchangeably great. He is immutably great. His power, no one can contend with God. There's no one that can contend with God. I've often referenced Psalm 2, but why do the nations rage and the peoples imagine a vain thing? It's an empty thing. And so the psalmist goes on, and we know it's David because of Acts chapter 4, but the psalmist is talking about the nations, the peoples, the rulers, the authorities trying to unshackle themselves as they view it from God, to cast off his authority. And God laughs. He literally laughs. There's not often that the scripture says that God laughs. You never want to hear that laughter. You never, ever, ever want to hear that laughter. That's a laughter of derision. That is a laughter of ultimate judgment. When God laughs in derision at those who are contesting him, you never want to be in that position. That is the worst possible position in the universe to be in. And God has established his son as ruler over Most High on Mount Zion. But Psalm 2, I think often when I think of the power and the unquestioned authority of God and the glory of God, the beauty of God, what if the psalmist in one place speaks of one thing I've desired to behold the beauty of God. I don't know how often we think of God in that way, and our human, earthly, fallen conception of beauty, even something that's pure and pristine, like a beautiful diamond, but we equate beauty with very mundane things. And so when we talk about God as being beautiful, I don't know that we often think of him in those terms, but he is indeed beautiful. The psalmist describes God as infinitely beautiful, and he desires to behold the beauty of God. That's his glory. And his victory, the fact that God alone is the one who champions all things. He rules all things. There is none that can contend with God. He's eternally that way. His majesty, page 5 of your notes, his splendor, his honor, and then ultimately his dominion. Several of the passages that we'll look at come from the book of Daniel when we look at the dominion. It's interesting to me to see how God reveals himself. Daniel, of course, talking about a teenage Jewish young man that finds himself exiled to Babylon and catapulted through the providence of God into a very high place, ultimately is a ruler, counseling the ruler over the most powerful nation in the ancient Near East, dealing with Nebuchadnezzar, and he's having direct discourse with the monarch. And we think we're a republic here in the United States. We're not a democracy, but we like to think we're a democracy. But we think of this egalitarian view of how we conduct ourselves and who is really over us and that kind of thing. I think at least in former times, the people in Britain had a better view of majesty. I think if you've seen these things, when you have a king and you see the authority of a king and simply the declaration of a king, we revolt about things like that. But that's part of our American history, but we didn't want to have that. But we have a king, and so Daniel speaks about God reducing the most powerful human beings in the ancient Near East to cattle. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar was literally reduced to a guy that was on his face eating grass because he challenged the authority of God. Daniel 2 says, I raise up kings, I set them down. God has not changed. You realize that the God who reduced Nebuchadnezzar to cattle and restored him, by the way, gave him back his cognition and his human attributes. He's the same God today as he's always been. He's never changed. He has the same authority today that he's always had. He's never diminished or increased in his authority, in his sovereignty, in his dominion. He's infinitely in ruler over all. So why is it right for God to exalt himself as head over all? Because he's God. Because no one question, and I'm thinking of the passage in Romans where the guy in the back of the room raises up his hands, or the one who's raising it. Why does God do these things? Well, who are you to challenge God? That's the answer that's given. And we find that to be sort of a brash response, sort of an unloving response, but we don't challenge God. We just simply don't challenge God. And God exalts himself as head over all because he is head over all, because he is God, because he is the one who's made all things by the declaration of his own word, let there be. He sustains all things. Psalm 113, verses 4 through 6, the Lord is high above all nations. His glory is above, this word above used twice now, above the heavens. Who is like the Lord our God? There is none like God who is enthroned on high. And then look at verse 6. Isn't this beautiful? This reminds me of the passage we looked at a moment ago in Isaiah 57 about, I dwell in a high and holy place, but I'm also with the one who is lowly and contrite of heart. And here is the God who is high above the nations, who's above the heavens, who is enthroned on high. In verse 6, who humbles himself to behold the things that are in heaven and on earth. He didn't have to do that. God was not required, of course, to humble himself to do anything. The fact that he humbles himself to make himself knowable by his creation is something he did to bring himself glory. The fact, and we get to benefit from that. The fact that we get to know our Creator. The fact that we get to have a personal knowledge of our Creator is all grace. He didn't have to do that. I mean, we create inanimate objects and they have no way of knowing us. We have relationships with all sorts of things that we make, and none of them know us. And we make these things. God made us, and he gives us the rational ability and the spiritual capacity to know him. He gives us minds and hearts through the Holy Spirit who indwells us, if we are truly born again, to know him. What an extraordinary thing that we can know God. Have you ever thought about that? That God has made us, and he not only has made us, he not only sustains us, but he enables us to know him personally, eternally, and to call him Father. Can you imagine such a thing? The God of all the universe, who is high above the nations, high above the heavens and the earth, that we get to call him Father, Abba. Not only Father, but this very intimate expression, Abba, Father. This personal term of endearment. What an extraordinary act of God's grace. And he humbles himself to give us this capacity to know him. And titles, Lord, is the most often used term to talk about his dominion, his sovereignty, his absolute authority over all. Page 6 of your notes, different terms, the Lord of the whole earth. And again, we're going to Psalm 97, one of the sovereignty psalms, Psalm 93, 97, 99. The Lord of the whole earth. The Lord of heaven, Daniel 5, verse 23. And then Acts 17 merges, if you will, those two previous titles, the Lord of the whole earth, the Lord of heaven. And here we have in Acts 17, verse 24, the Lord of heaven and earth. And again, what's being communicated is the totality, the comprehensiveness of God's dominion and his rule and his reign and his authority and his sovereignty over all that is the Lord of. And of course, we have the word kurios, Lord, in the New Testament. That's a Greek word. And we have Adonai. Remember, I said earlier, sometimes you've got Lord and it's all capitals. That's Yahweh or Jehovah. And then when you have this Lord and it's spelled the way it is with Lord of the whole earth in Psalm 97:5, that's Adonai. It talks of his mastery, talks of his dominion, talks about his authority. Deuteronomy 10, verse 17, Lord of lords and Lord of kings. And so the point that's being made here is absolute authority, that there's none greater. There's none even in contention with the authority of God, none that would be able to match up with God or to question him. Page 7 of your notes, another title. So we looked at the word Lord, often used, either Kurios in the New Testament or Adonai or Yahweh in the Old Testament, and King, King in the New Testament. We get the Melech in the Hebrew. Melchizedek was a Zedek is righteous and Melech is king. So Melchizedek is a king of righteousness. But that's the Old Testament word for king. But these are obviously closely related. And when we think of king, we're thinking of nobility. We're thinking of dominion. We're thinking of majesty. We're thinking of authority. We're thinking of the ability to absolutely determine the outcome based upon one's will. We're not accustomed to that. We're used to voting about things. We're used to having representation and voting. And candidly, we're used to, if things don't go our way, we're used to challenging things. Even though we may not be entitled to challenge them, we like to challenge things. All of that is alien to God. Absolutely. Everything we don't get a vote. We don't get to challenge. We don't have, you know, any of that, all of that. The whole notion of kingship is alien to our culture. We have trouble relating to these things. But if we look back at history and you look at how kings throughout history, especially ancient Near Eastern kings, people would walk into, well, they would crawl into the courtroom. They would fall on their face. They would wait for a scepter to be extended. You remember Esther? I mean, how was she going to go in? And she was being implored to go in and address the king and to ask for clemency, to ask for mercy to be extended, just to have a conversation with the king. You just didn't walk into the court with the king and I'm here to raise an issue. I'd like to have 5 minutes of your time. That was just absolutely not the case. Absolutely not the case. The king had absolute authority to determine if, number one, you lived or died while you were in his presence, and whether, if he chose to let you live, whether he would hear you, and if he chose to hear you, whether he would pay any attention to what you said, and if he paid any attention to what you said, how he would respond to what he heard. All of that is absolutely alien to our world. But the essence of a king is ultimate determination. What I just described, human kings, human monarchs, are fallen, and they have they're depraved. They have sinful inclinations. They're often unjust. That's rebellion going on there. But in any event, it's a challenge. But our God is one who is absolutely righteous, who is absolutely just, who is absolutely holy, who does all things perfectly well, with absolute wisdom, for his glory and for our good. All of those things, perfectly, infinitely, eternally, immutably. So we look at these essence, these descriptions of king, and we think of throne, and we think, and of course, God is incorporeal. He doesn't occupy space in a delimited fashion, but the word throne, he sits on a throne. That's because we're human and we need help in understanding these things. And so we call this anthropomorphic language. It's language that is accustomed to our existence. So God is sitting on a throne. He's not literally sitting on a throne, but he's ruling as the monarch. He's ruling as the king in absolute authority over all the earth. In Psalm 47, the king, the great king over all the earth, reigning without any limitation whatsoever. And then Daniel, king of heaven and the like. Well, those are Old Testament names. Lord, king. And then these king of heaven, king of the earth, king of all gods. And of course, Psalm 95, when we talk about the king of all gods, the word God is used in lowercase, of course, because there's only one true God. And the New Testament reveals to us that all of these idols, all of these pretenders, the imaginations that we have that they're God, but they're not. Ultimately, they're demons. They find their energy from Satan himself. They're contesting with God himself. And they're not true God, but they're evil. They're evil. They're anything that pretends to be God is evil. What's the first commandment? I'm the Lord your God. You shall have what? No other gods before me. And so he will have no challenge to his kingship, no challenge to his authority. He alone is God. The New Testament, Revelation 15, 3 and 4, the King of the nations talks about his rule over all authority. And then the King of kings. You have to love that. Lord of lords and King of kings. 1 Timothy 1:17. Three descriptions here that are helpful for us to understand the kingship of God: eternal, immortal, and invisible. Eternal, his infinity with respect to time, his eternality, without beginning, without end, kingship forever, without an inception, without a termination point, has always been king, will always be king, because he is and always will be king. Immortal, obviously related, but imperishable, never changing, his immutability, never diminishing in any way. So the kingship from beginning to end, the Alpha and the Omega, without any form of diminishment at all. And then invisibility, his incorporeal nature, unhindered by physical limitations or restraints in any way. Sovereign rule, the titles, again, so we've looked at Lord, King, Sovereign, Rule, and Master. And you may remember at the beginning, John Murray was talking about the unquestioned absolute authority, rule, and government of God. That's the first line in page one. Well, here we've got those same attributes being described here. When Murray was talking about authority, rule, and government, that correlates to sovereign, rule, and master. Sovereignty, his authority, rule, and master, his government. Of course, we're looking at his way in which he exercises his authority over us. But his sovereignty, he's over us, he's above us, he rules us, he has ultimate authority over us. But to think that God rules us, he directs us, he guides us. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him. And what will he do? Direct your paths. God is a ruler. He not only is authoritative over us, but we should not lean on our own wisdom. We should not be prideful. We should not be deluded by a sense of self-sufficiency or self-authority. But in all our ways, acknowledge him. And why would we do that? Because he is authoritative over all things. In all our ways, acknowledge him. Trust in him. And he will make your path straight. He condescends to be with the one who is lowly and contrite of heart, the one who is humble, who depends upon him, who sees God as the as just and ruler and wise and powerful, who causes all things to work together for good to those who love him, to those who are called according to his purpose. What a remarkable promise that God causes all things to work together for good. That's because he is perfectly good. And he's created us to enjoy this attribute of his goodness. And why do we know that he causes all things to work together for good? Because he is sovereign. Because there are no maverick molecules, to go back to that description of R.C. Sproul. If God is not sovereign, then we have no comfort in knowing that he causes all things to work together for good. But because he truly is sovereign, because he is majestic and he is absolute in his rule and his authority and his supremacy over all, then you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that what he says is true and that he does, in fact, not only have the intention, but the capacity, and in fact, he will honor his commitment to cause all things to work together for good. So these doctrines are immeasurably practical. They're not just something that we should stash away in our minds, but to take great comfort in the authority of God. I just want to make, this is not in your notes, but I'd like to just give you in the time that remains just a few things to meditate upon. One person has said that there is hardly a more comforting truth for God's people than that God is the absolute sovereign, ruling his kingdom unfailingly for the purposes of his glory and his people's good. This should give you great comfort. This should be a pillow on which you can rest your head at night to know that God is sovereign and to know that he is good, regardless of what perplexities you may have or pain you may have, problems you may have, but to know that none of them are outside of God's control. There are no independent things happening. All of this is under his providential care, and you know that he's ruling. Another comment that I thought was so helpful, we think of the foreknowledge of God, and the foreknowledge of God, he knows what is going to take place. Why does he know what will take place? Number one, because he is omniscient and he knows all things perfectly. There is nothing that escapes his knowledge. But because he has decreed what will take place. He has decreed what will take place. And so what takes place is ultimately a function of his eternal decree that he works out in creation and providence and making us and sustaining us and ruling over us in his most holy, wise, and powerful way. So God is the Lord of history, past and present and future. And he knows this, bear this in mind. He knows the name of each person. And he's planned what will happen to that person centuries before that person is born. Let me give you one example before I close. If you were to look at 1 Kings 13:2, you might jot this down. 1 Kings 13:2, there's a reference to Josiah and what Josiah would do. 300 years later, what is described in 1 Kings 13:2 took place literally in 2 Kings 23:14 through 17. Painstaking detail. 1 Kings 13:2, 2 Kings 23:14 to 17. 300 years later, what was said took place exactly as described. And why was that? Because God is the God of all history, because God is sovereign over all that takes place. He knows the name, he knows your name, he knows my name. He knows the name of those who have gone before us, he knows the name of those who will come after us. And he knows from eternity past what will take place in our lives, because number one, he's omniscient, and number two, because he's sovereign, and he's decreed all these things. And the one that he knows, in child of God, he will cause all things to work together for good in your life. All things. All means all. For good. That doesn't mean without pain. It doesn't mean without difficulty. It doesn't mean without confusion. It doesn't mean that you will necessarily understand it. But it means that it will be for good. And how do I know that? Because God has said it. Because God has said it. And because God is sovereign. He's the King over all. He's the Lord over all. And that should be a source of immeasurable comfort and consolation.